Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 10 days, on August 13th, Fidel Castro turns 80, if he's alive. Since word came down this week that an unwell Fidel was turning authority over to his brother Raul, Cuba and the Cuban diaspora, from Miami to Washington to points worldwide, have been crackling with speculation about what comes next. Will Fidel return? Is he even alive? Will the revolution Castro championed at Cuba's helm for almost 50 years go on? Will the counter-revolution begin? Will Cuban communism morph into a China-style market economy? Havana has plans, so do Miami's exiles, so does Washington. And then there are the Cuban people. Up next on Point, Beyond Fidel, the way ahead for Cuba. Here, let's just hear this from a Havana announcer reading a statement from Cuban leader Fidel Castro on state television in Spanish on Tuesday. The statement reads in part, "They cannot make up news now because it would not be ethical."
Yo no puedo inventar noticias buenas, nos dijo el comandante. Porque no sería ético.
There's the news part of the statement. In Miami, a Cuban exile celebrated the news of Castro's illness, said that the time for regime change in Cuba is now.
Forget about the United States. We need to show Cuba that we could do it ourselves here, Cubans in Miami. We can't wait for the Americans to do anything. We have to take things in our own hand. We need to go to Cuba and invade them ourselves.
Invade them. One view, there are many others. We are joined now from Washington by Lillian Guerra. She's assistant professor of Caribbean history at Yale University and author of The Myth of Jose Marti. She's a first-generation Cuban-American who travels back to Cuba half a dozen times a year. She was just there in June. Lillian Guerra, thank you very much for being with us.
Nice to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Also with us from Miami, Florida, Brian Littell, Senior Research Associate at the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies at the University of Miami. He has worked for the U.S. foreign intelligence agencies for 35 years, served as the CIA's National Intelligence Officer for Latin America from 1990 to 94. He's author of After Fidel, the inside story of Castro's regime and Cuba's next leader. Brian Littell, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, thank you. Good to be with you.
So let's dive in here. We may hear from Havana at some point in this hour, but the telephone lines there are rough. Lillian Guerra, you're a first-generation Cuban-American. You pay a lot of attention. You're back there often. Your first response to the events of this week and where you see them pointing Cuba.
Well, I think that, first of all, I had the same reaction that probably a lot of Cubans had in Cuba and that a lot of people later told me by phone and by email when I spoke with them. And that was panic. I mean, I think what is very unusual or what's considered unusual was the fact that Fidel announced anything about his condition. In the past, you know, people know that he has been ill on many occasions. He's disappeared, in fact, from public view for months at a time, as long as 9 months in 1996 to 97. And that, you know, led to great rumors, et cetera, and concerns and fear. But the fact that he announced at this time had particular importance. Now, I think that right after the panic, there was kind of a sense of relief. And people have told me that they feel that it's a dress rehearsal, that it's a strategy on the part of the Cuban government to show, especially right now, that the United States has its hands tied in terms of the Middle East and is distracted by all that's going on there, that it's a perfect time to sort of test out the transfer of power and to show the world and to show Cubans in Cuba and abroad that they can handle it.
In other words, there's a Cuban view that says Fidel's alive, he may very well come back, but this is sort of a walkthrough to test the waters on how it goes when he actually does have to step down or die.
Yeah, I mean, the extreme version of the view, if that view, is that, in fact, it's all invented. And he's not really sick. And there is also the rumor that it's Raul that's sick and not Fidel. I mean, I think that that's the latest wrinkle in the story that we're not really hearing.
Raul's 75, and he also has not shown up this week. Brian Littell, at the other end of the kind of speculation spectrum here, is the notion, the idea that Fidel may be dead already, that a transition is well underway.
Well, he might be dead. I think he's probably not. I think he's gravely ill. He has some very, very serious problems. We've been noticing and observing for quite some time, for most of this year, his physical and even cognitive decline. His speeches became fewer, shorter, and there were many rambling lapses in his public appearances.
He's fallen sprawling in public, famously.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. He fainted a few years ago. He's stumbled. He was clearly in sharp decline. Raul is 75, as Lillian said. He's been a long time heavy drinker. He's an alcoholic, unreformed alcoholic. And he's been drinking.
Is that propaganda? Is that disputed, or does everybody accept that as fact? Lillian, is that what you understand from?
I would say in Cuba, no one knows that, and no one says that. In fact, people, you know very little about the lives of their leaders. But in particular, they know very little about Raul. He's never been popular. I'm sure your other guests could speak more to this. But you know, people
not popular
see him.
Because he was pretty rough during the revolution. Executions, his responsibility at some points there.
Yes, and more recently, in 1994, when they had the first and really only large, massive anti-government riots in August of 94 in Centro Havana, Raul went on national television live and said he would send the tanks in if the people did not relax, put their sticks down. And in fact, about an hour after he made that statement, Fidel Castro responded, I think, and many people think, to what Raul had to say by showing up in the middle of the rioting, you know, and making an appearance.
You won't beat these people down. You won't beat me down. Brian Littell, I know you've looked at the Raul story very closely, but let me just first get your sense of what's going on here. Do you see the transition from Fidel to whatever follows as underway now?
Yes, I do. I think it's been underway for some time. In my book, After Fidel, which was published last year, I actually wrote that I thought that Raul was already acting to some extent as a regent, filtering and amending decisions by Fidel because Fidel's condition was, even a year ago, conspicuously deteriorating. My sense of this became much stronger at the beginning of June, just several weeks ago, when Raul became the focus of extraordinary, unprecedented coverage, and very intense coverage in the Cuban media, the Communist Party newspaper. And there was an exceptional long article about Raul that was published that must have been done by his own personal public relations staff. It attempted to portray Raul as sympathetic, as a family man, a father, a grandfather, as a man who would perform in power in a collegial and collaborative fashion.
So whatever problems had been there, meet him again for the first time. Here's Raul.
Here's a different Raul. Mm-hmm. This is a Raul. The propaganda, the regime is now portraying Raul as a different person. He's sympathetic. He's not the hardline Stalinist executioner that most of us and most Cubans remember. They're trying to change the impression of Raul, I think that Raul now is exercising considerable power.
We'll look at that, and we'll look at the other men around power in Cuba. But I guess the fundamental question that I want to put to each of you is, what about the revolution? Whatever exactly that means these days, whatever it's evolved into, Lillian Garrett, you first, does it go on beyond Fidel Castro? Does it remain essentially a communist, socialist system In the next generation? Does it become a mini version of China with the market taking over while Communist Party still rules the roost? Or does it, as many in Washington and Miami clearly hope, does it break wide open and change entirely? Lillian, what do you expect?
Well, I hope, in fact, that there will be a gradual transition and the United States, frankly, will stay out. I think that Cubans in Miami are not trusted by Cubans in Cuba. I think most Cubans in Cuba fear their intentions. They recognize the incredible ignorance that most of at least the organized leadership of the Cuban-American community has of conditions in Cuba, of how people get through life, how they conceive of life, of the government. I think that Cubans are very nationalistic. I think that their understanding of the revolution is, in fact, quite different than even their own leaders' understanding of the revolution. I think that that's the other mistake that we often make, is that we just decide that Cubans may be very critical of their government and what they want is a U.S.-style democracy. And I don't think that a lot of Cubans want that. They may want elections, they may want the free press, but they don't want Walmart. And the closest that Cubans came, really, I think, to subverting the government, their own government from within, and creating a sort of new revolution was in the mid-1990s, when the Cuban government really allowed for economic independence, for people to set up businesses, and people really took advantage of that to the extent that they jeopardized the public school system, for instance, because so many teachers left school to set up their own businesses or to work in tourism. Now, what that created was a mass of people who were autonomous of the state, independent economically and independent in terms of how they thought about it, in terms of access to information. And what happened was they rolled it back. And they rolled it back in part because of the increasing hard line taken by the United States. And whenever the U.S. responds with hostility towards Cuba, it strengthens the embargo, does the kinds of things that the new regulations since 2004 have done, eliminate contact, reduce contact with the U.S., the Cuban government responds in kind by, in fact, repressing, in many respects, their own people's autonomy.
So some market reforms, then some rollback. Let's hear Fidel Castro just a bit here from 1960, talking with American reporters about his relationship with then-Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev.
Khrushchev is friends. Don't you know? Soviet government have no monopoly in Cuba, no factory, no investment, no colony. Never we, the Cuban people, felt so free as now.
Are you a communist?
Well, wait for the history. The history will tell what we are.
Fidel Castro talking to American reporters in 1960. He's not talking this week. We've been joined by Brian Littell, former CIA National Intelligence Officer for Latin America, author of After Fidel, The Inside Story of Castro's Regime and Cuba's Next Leader, and by Lillian Guerra, joining us from Washington, professor of Caribbean history at Yale University, first-generation Cuban-American back there a lot, author of The Myth of Jose Martí. I want to turn for just a moment to Havana. Gary Marks joins us. He's Latin America correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. He's been all over this story. Gary, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure.
What is the latest? Is there any more news? Has Raul made an appearance? Do Cubans know any more about the precise health of Fidel Castro or the plans of Raul?
The short answer is no. Fidel has not appeared in public, and neither has Raul, although the front page of Granma, the Communist Party daily today, prominently displayed above the fold several paragraphs of a prominent speech Raul gave in early July, essentially saying that the Communist Party is going to lead the revolution into the future, et cetera, et cetera. So that's been our only word from him. And again, it's a speech that was dated from July 1st.
What is the atmosphere in Havana? This seems like an awful lot of mystery around a very crucial development, the leader of 47 years out of sight and rumors that he may not even be alive. What's the atmosphere there?
Well, I've been living here, Tom, for 4 years, and I've never seen anything like it. It's just an eerie silence, essentially, has permeated Havana. I mean, normally the streets are bustling, people are shouting, there's music, boomboxes. I mean, it's a city that is alive. And today, well, since the announcement was made Monday night, it's just an eerie silence. People are whispering to each other, they're talking to each other, but they're confused. They really don't know what's happening. And the key thing, Tom, is it's a police state, it's a one-party. They don't know what's happening. They don't know what the rules are now. They don't know what's next. So there's a lot of fear and a lot of uncertainty right now.
Do you think, I mean, your assessment of the Cuban people, that's a great big phrase, it's got millions of people in it, but do they want Fidel's way to go on, or do they want something else?
Oh, that's the big question, and it's very confusing. Some people want to continue the revolution. They're pleased, obviously, with progress made in health, education, et cetera, et cetera. But there's also a huge percentage of the population here that really wants change. They want more economic opportunities. They want more political freedom, et cetera, et cetera. So it sort of runs the gamut. And you got to understand that Cuba is in a closed society. People don't really understand Western-style democracy here. They don't understand what capitalism means in the fullest sense. So there are a lot of people who are afraid of change, but why are they afraid of change? In part, they're afraid of change because they are bombarded by information about how horrible the rest of the world is, about how horrible capitalism is, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very hard to gauge that type of thing, but you can say that there are supporters of the revolution. Even critics of the revolution admire Fidel. He's put them on the map. He's an iconic figure in Latin America. But that doesn't mean those people don't want change. There's a lot of people that really want the economy to improve. They really want the economy to open up. And they want more contact with the outside world.
They may admire his international standing, but there's also clearly fear. You quote a 32-year-old chemist, Gary Marks, there, who met with you outside his neighborhood so he wouldn't be spied on, saying he thought it possible that Castro's faking the illness to smoke out his enemies, to bring forward people who want change.
That shows the level of distrust, the level of informants. They're called chivatos here. They're everywhere. There are plainclothes security officers walking around all over the city. Nobody trusts each other, and nobody is honestly talking about what they feel in public in terms of what they think is going on with Fidel, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the government line is everything's normal. Fidel's recovering. Raul and this sort of second generation leaders are sort of forming a caretaker government, but that everything is normal. The system will continue. That's the line. It's given on the television. It's been done at these rallies that are being held at different work sites. But people are very afraid. They're not sure what's happening. And when you're not sure what's happening in Cuba, you basically keep your mouth shut and you don't voice your opinion to a stranger.
Gary, if your sense, you describe the constraints that Cubans live under, but if the people want something else, whether evolutionary or revolutionary in its nature, how do you think that will emerge?
You know, it's very difficult to say at this point. I mean, my feeling is Cuba is locked down so tight that the only way change will come, I think, is through the government. I mean, I heard Brian Littell, who I respect tremendously, talking about how, you know, is Raul going to sort of form a China-type model?
Mm-hmm.
There are elements, powerful people in the government, who would like to open the economy. Whether or not they can do that over the long run, we don't know. But it seems to me it's got to come sort of from inside the government. But then again, Tom, I could be completely wrong. I could wake up this afternoon or tomorrow and there could be riots in the street. But I don't see that. I've been here 4 years. The place is locked down. There's tremendous fear here. And people, just Cubans, are not, I don't see them going out on the streets right now. So that's my view in the short term. But again, it's anybody's guess what's going to happen.
What a wild situation. Gary Marks in Havana, Cuba, Latin America correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Gary, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
We'll turn to Brian Littell and Lillian Guerra. First, Jane's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jane. What do you think? What do you see?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I don't see the fear there. Of course, I haven't been in Havana for 9 years, so it's been a while. But the Cubans I talked to when I visited Cuba were, of course, wanting the economy to change. Even the people in the government I talked to wanted that to happen, wanted the economy to improve. It's such a poor, poor country, but that's mostly because of the blockade. It's really not an embargo. It's a blockade.
Well, a lot of other countries trade with Cuba. Of course, it's the United States
that
doesn't.
That's right.
But, I mean, they're open to a lot of the rest of the... But you're saying you think Cubans want it to go on status quo, or they want major change, or just kind of change at the edges?
Oh, they want changes. They want changes, especially in the economy, and they want to have not to get by just day to day. They want to be able to plan for a future. And that could
Bob, can
change.
I jump in here at some point?
Yes, please. Jane, thanks for your call. Lillian, what about this fear factor and what Cubans want and how it's going to be expressed?
I have three comments. I don't think the change, real change in terms of people's daily lives and how much they get paid at work and their accessibility to goods that are quite expensive given their salaries, et cetera, I don't think that kind of change is going to come through a change in the government. I think, in fact, Cubans are very familiar with capitalism. They've been living under a state capitalist system since 1989. Increasingly, the state's resources have entirely come from its state enterprises that are usually joint ventures with foreign investors. Cubans are very familiar with capitalism. And in fact, what they see is that whether they work in a state capitalist enterprise or they work for the government in the regular socialist sector, they are not paid for their labor what they feel they should be paid, which is a just wage. And people that are at least 40 years old and older, which is a good chunk of the population, remember what that was like. And younger people don't remember it, but that's what they want. And I think that it is a mistake to believe that Cubans are thinking that somehow the U.S. or the Cubans in Miami or Raul's Chinese model is going to provide them relief from this situation. I think that, in fact, what we do constantly outside of Cuba is underestimate how often and how astutely Cubans on a regular basis make political calculations. People in their neighborhoods know who are the chivatos. They know who are the people
the
that
informers.
Are confiable.
Mm-hmm.
And they know how to stay away from those people. I mean, the black market economy is the economy, and it has been in place for a hell of a long time, a lot longer than
So you're suggesting the status quo, that period. They kind of like it the way it is and maybe
No, I'm not suggesting status quo. I'm actually suggesting that they want change, but they recognize that the kinds of models that are being floated out there and that they have experienced, the kind of capitalist system that they've experienced in Cuba since it turned to tourism and foreign investment, mm-hmm. is not a just system. I mean, people, you know, in Cuba recognize that some of their best hospitals have been turned over to foreigners. And Cuba's doctors, some of Cuba's best doctors, are in fact serving foreigners for a fee. And the whole notion that they have to pay for health care in order for it to be good health care, most Cubans find offensive. They find, and they were taught that health care should be free.
So they want more of the fruit of the market, I guess, but are wary, you're saying, of the inequities that may come with that. Brian Littell, what's your view on that? Cubans, no capitalism, says Lillian.
That's not what I'm saying, sir.
I thought that's exactly what you said. Your words.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying
But you
that
did
they,
say that.
They, no, I'm saying that the kind of capitalism that they have experienced, which is a state monopoly capitalism, if you replace it with corporate capitalism, is not going to be a just mm-hmm. system. What Cubans want is the kind of entrepreneurial capitalism that allows for them to own their businesses and to get paid a fair wage. And they also want access to the kinds of things that are now being granted to foreigners because foreigners have more money than they do.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's not going to go away. That reality is not going to go away. So I think many Cubans, I mean, to get to the point about the status quo, I think many Cubans would prefer the status quo over the possible transformation mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. in fact, Brian has spoken about. I mean, that massive change, unless it is regulated by a government that is actually representative of the people and interested in their interests mm-hmm. before the interests of Cuban Miami or foreign investors, if they finally get that kind of government, then they will have a chance to really, you know, own land to have a flourishing economy that in which they play a role, and they're not just simply workers, you know, getting whatever they can.
Brian, how about it? How do you see that perspective? How do you see what's coming here?
Tom, I think that Gary Marx was on the mark in almost everything he said. The Cuban people really want change, and I'm not speaking just of the Cubans in the street, of the working Cubans, but of the leadership as well. It seems to me from all of my conversations with all kinds of people who are experts in Cuban affairs that almost everybody, even in the leadership, I think even including Raul Castro, is really just waiting with some considerable anticipation for the moment when they can begin to bring about changes.
But how much, in what direction? Lillian Guerra says, look, they've become accustomed to certain kinds of guarantees from the government, shielded from certain kinds of market inequities, and that mm-hmm. they don't want to let go of. Do you agree, Brian?
I, Yeah, I agree that the Cuban people generally are going to continue wanting to receive the benefits that the state provides in health and education and in other forms of the social safety net. They're going to continue wanting those and expecting those. But I think the Cuban people want to be able to participate more freely in a decentralized, more entrepreneurial economy. And I think almost everybody in the Cuban leadership is willing to go in that direction once Fidel is no longer calling the shots. Mm. You know, the military is a good model. Raul began reforming the military in the 1990s. After the Soviet Union disappeared and the subsidies ended, Raul decided that the military would be allowed to engage in entrepreneurship. He sent some of his senior generals to Western countries, mostly in Europe. They studied Western management and business techniques. They brought those techniques back to Cuba. They applied those skills in the military-run, the military-managed enterprises that they run. So they're getting a lot of practice. Raul and his military officers have been getting a lot of practice in capitalism, as
practice,
Lillian says.
Right, but also control. Brian, Lillian, please stand by. I want to turn to Miami for another voice here. Aldo Leyva joins us. He's a director with the Cuban American National Foundation, a Cuban exile group in Miami. Mr. Leyva, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
How do you see this moment in Cuba? We've seen the dancing in the streets and the kind of call for big change right away, and you know that's been in Miami and the Cuban exile community for a long time. Do you see counter-revolution coming in Cuba? Do you see evolution along the lines we're hearing described today?
I see actually a true revolution, and by that I mean if we define it as toppling a decaying, corrupt dictatorship, that's what I see coming. I think that the people in Cuba are waiting and demanding for that change. I think, as Gary Mark said earlier, there is a palpable fear in the street because basically the Cuban regime now more than ever has really stepped up its repressive mechanisms, the mass groups, the young men with baseball bats patrolling the neighborhoods, that kind of thing is happening. But I think that transition, as we define it, that is a movement towards democracy, a movement towards a free market, that is happening. That's already underway, not only in the people on the street, but also within the government.
But do you think they really want to wash away the whole legacy of these 47 years, or as Lillian Guerra suggests, that they want to hang on to some of the guarantees and assumptions they've been able to hold under Fidel?
Well, I think that we have to look at what these accomplishments have been. First of all, as far as education, the literacy rate has done quite well. However, if you match it as it did in Costa Rica during the same time, Costa Rica, without tyranny, without totalitarian dictatorship, has accomplished the same goals in literacy. So education improved, but now Cubans want the right to access the Internet, read the books they want to read. They don't have that right now.
Will it be a peaceful transition?
That is what our organization encouraged, and that's what we want. I think that would be the best. You know, enough blood has been spilled between Cubans. I think it should be a peaceful transition.
Do you want Washington to lean on Havana in this period or not?
I think that Washington should join the international community and provide as much support as possible to the opposition movement, the dissidents who are there, who are the spearhead of the voices of freedom in Cuba right now, but also provide support and guarantees to people in the system right now who are willing to take that risk and step up and say, I can't lie anymore. I can't do this to my people anymore.
That's a narrow path to tread, but we appreciate the spirit of it. Aldo Leyva with the Cuban American National Foundation in Miami, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Lourdes is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Lourdes. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am a Cuban-American, and I was born in Cuba and left in 1988 when I was 11 years old.
Okay.
I have a lot of family in Cuba, and if you talk to the people in Cuba and you talk to family members, everyone is desperate for change. We have gone through 47 years of not just economic depression, but also political oppression, and people really want to transition from this. I think people forget that it's not easier to obtain these kinds of opinions from people on the street because people are really afraid of repercussion and that they're really afraid of being put in jail for their own for their own opinion.
Right. We understand that. Lourdes, let me just ask you, because Americans have all kinds of impressions of the Cuban exile community. Was your family a rich Cuban family that wants to go back and reclaim land? Or do you think ordinary Cubans, maybe poor Cubans, share this view of repression and let's toss it all off?
No, my family was not rich. My family was a normal working class in Cuba, and it took, I mean, they wanted to leave since 1962. It took them almost 30 years to leave Cuba, and we have no, even though we lost our house and we lost property there, we don't have any intentions of claiming it. I think that we forget that the population in Miami, the Cuban-American community in Miami, is not only composed of people that came early in the 60s, but there's been a huge immigration wave in the 90s and also during the 80s of people that didn't have land and were not rich and any of these things. And we forget that, and we tend to sort of view the Cuban-American community in Miami.
All right, through an old lens. And let me just ask you, finally, Lourdes, do you think it's going to change or not?
I think so. I think it's going to change. I think people are just too desperate for change, and I think it's going to happen. I don't know. I think people are afraid of it just because they've been under a regime that has provided for them for such a long time. But I think people are desperate for change.
Lourdes, thank you very much for your call. Lillian, desperate for change. Is that what you hear when you're home with your family?
I think so. I think people do. I mean, one of the mistakes that, again, I think that we often make outside of Cuba is that we see these dissidents in Cuba as somehow heroic figures, or we think that in Cuba they are seen as such. And in fact, dissidents are seen in general by certainly my family, and I have 150 and some relatives and a lot of friends and colleagues in Cuba. They're seen as people who are puppets of the United States and puppets of these organizations in Miami that many of them, as Lourdes just said, recognize don't represent the vast majority of the people.
But if you agree that Cubans are desperate for change, wouldn't that produce dissidents, given the political system there?
Yes and no, but I think, yes it does and yes it, and no it doesn't. I mean, dissidence happens all the time, depends on how you see it. People don't stand on a street corner with a sign that says, you know, down with Castro because it's illegal. People, on the other hand, in their workplaces, rely on pilfering everything they can and reselling that. And everybody at your workplace is complicitous with that, including often managers. And so, you know, the black market is actually one of the means by which people constantly express resistance to control.
That's sort of working the system. Not changing it exactly.
Oh, but they do change it. I mean, for instance, internet access. The number of people that in the last 10 years, I mean, when I lived in Cuba for a year and a half doing my dissertation research, there was no internet access. People didn't have it. Now I have almost no one, except for my relatives who live in Pinar del Río or out in the middle of nowhere. Mm. You know, I have almost no one in Cuba that I can't contact through the internet. And it's because people who work for the state, who have the various codes to get access to servers, sell those codes, or sometimes they just give it out for free. So people have a computer at their workplace and they have Hotmail accounts.
So that's working sort of through the system, and yet we've got a transition moment where things might change more dramatically. John's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
A question for Brian. And this has to do with, say, post-Fidel at some point, whenever that might occur.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the threat of the interference of Hugo Chavez is and those Chavistas on the island, and specifically their alignment with Felipe Perez Roque.
The foreign minister in Cuba.
Yeah, I've seen that he is the person who most likely would be aligned with them. And the second part of that question is, just the broad overall, what might there be for the United States to do, you know, since we have a kind of a record which in some ways ties our hand behind our back.
Bay of Pigs right on, yeah.
What might be able to do to sort of help draw Cuba towards democracy?
Let us pick those up, John. First, Venezuela, very big role now, big relationship with Cuba. Can you describe that for us, Brian?
The Venezuelan role is enormous. The subsidy from the Chavez government to Cuba amounts to about $2.5 billion right now on an annualized basis this year.
Out of Venezuela's oil wealth and energy sort of slid into the role that the Soviets used to play.
It's not as big as the Soviet subsidy, which was about $5 or $6 billion a year, but in relative terms, it's really quite enormous. It's mostly oil, but it's also some investment and other things. The relationship that Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez has, as everyone knows, is intimate, very close. I don't think, though, that Raul Castro has the same kind of relationship at all with Chavez. It may be that Raul is not going to want to have that kind of relationship with Venezuela. But as the caller suggests, it's going to be a very difficult choice for Raul.
$2.5 billion is a lot of money.
Well, the money is really making the critical difference now. The Cuban economy without that money would be on the ropes. So Raul is going to have face a very difficult challenge. I'd like your listeners to know, Tom, I'd like you to know that I think that once Raul has a chance to consolidate and to begin to exercise power in his own right, that he's going to want better relations with the United States. And I'm hoping that that if any such opportunity is presented, that the United States is going to respond.
What about the young foreign minister that John was asking about, Felipe Perez Roque?
Felipe Perez Roque is a mirror image of Fidel, and all of my information suggests that Raul Castro will not want to work very closely with him at all.
But he's a lot younger, 41. Is he sort of waiting in the wings to step in, or is Raul's position secure in your view?
Raul Castro controls the three most powerful and influential institutions in Cuba, Tom. The military, the security and intelligence services, and now the Communist Party. He recently saw to the recreation of the secretariat of the Communist Party, and he dominates it personally and through several very close allies. Felipe Perez Roque is in charge of the foreign ministry. His institutional base of power is very, very minimal compared to the bases of power that Raul controls.
And what about the U.S. role here? President Bush just last month approved this U.S. policy to hasten and assist a Cuban turn to democracy after Fidel Castro. What do you expect? What would you like to see from the U.S.?
Tom, I think the dissidents, the so-called dissidents, the human rights activists, they need a little bit more of an explanation than what your audience has heard so far.
Mm-hmm.
When we speak of dissidents, what we're talking about are people who have small libraries in their homes and they lend out books to their neighbors. We're talking about so-called independent journalists, reporters who send news reports out of Cuba mostly by the internet. We're talking about people who want to form free labor unions, and we're talking about human rights activists, people whose relatives and husbands and fathers are serving long prison terms because they loaned books to their neighbors, because they speak their minds independently.
And the implication for U.S. role?
The United States, the international community, should be supporting this embryonic civil society, this embryonic free civil society, independent civil society.
What does support mean in an era when regime change gets thrown around pretty easily?
Tom, let me emphasize one more thing about these so-called dissidents, the human rights activists. Every one of them espouses nonviolence. These are Cuba's Martin Luther Kings, Cuba's Gandhis.
I really disagree with that view. Forgive me, Brian.
Why, Lillian? What do you see?
You know, I think that there is a small group of people that several years ago had these independent libraries. They were almost all of them closed down. A lot of independent journalists as well had to leave the country when they passed a law called La Ley Mordaza, which essentially made it illegal for people to write from Cuba and get paid for those writings as journalists.
That sounds pretty bad. So
it's bad, but I'm saying that that's really not the vast majority of the dissidents and people that are receiving money. I mean, imagine if I'm living in Cuba and I'm receiving money from a foreign government that has spent 47 years trying to subvert my government. I'm receiving money from that government. You know, how are my neighbors going to view me? Are they going to view me as anything other than an agent for a foreign intelligence service? I mean, I think that's how, you know, my own relatives living in Centro Habana see a lot of those dissidents. Now I have to say, I mean, I was present last summer when there were great protests, and some of them were led by these paid dissidents. The protests that are the most effective, in fact, are often the ones that are actually funny, where they use a sense of humor to criticize the regime openly. I mean, there are a group of 50 dissidents that marched down the streets of Centro Habana, started throwing rocks at these construction workers that were restoring a hospital that's going to be opened only to foreigners. And they had these signs that said, "We prefer Bush the terrorist over Fidel Castro the electrician." Now, the reason that was funny is that Cubans in the height of the summer season were dealing with blackouts, like 20 hours a day. People were so hot. And when people saw these signs, they just started laughing. And it was completely effective. Now, these guys were all rounded up within 4 or 5 blocks, but I was present when I saw that protest. And all the neighbors were talking about, oh, these are the guys who get paid. But, you know, it was the first time that they didn't actually, you know, say the names of these people and kind of spit on that, on the idea that somehow they were, really doing something for positive change. Most of the time, that's how these dissidents are seen. If you're receiving money from a foreign agency that is actively trying to subvert the Cuban government, you know, in Cuba, you are seeing it as a foreign intelligence spy.
So what are we going to see? Laughter or tears or shouting? Let me turn to our listeners. Anna's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Anna. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just had a quick comment. I have a lot of friends from Mexico and from other Latin American countries.
Yes.
That have admired, that thought that the Cuba is much better off, that their political system or, you know, provides much better for their people, because clearly capitalism has not been a good recipe for, has been a bad model for most Latin American and South American countries.
So what are you hoping for in Cuba, Anna?
Maybe a capitalist approach would not be the best thing for Cuba. I mean, the way that it's been implemented in other South American countries. I mean, clearly they're doing very poorly, and maybe it's better for the people to continue some kind of communist regime.
So watch out for the baby in the bathwater. Thanks, Anna. Let's get a call from Toronto. Tom's on the line. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. My wife and I have been to Cuba several times, maybe the last 8 or 9 years. And we've toured the country quite extensively. We've rented cars and toured from both sides of the country. And I really think the Cuban people really do want change. A little bit of capitalism would be a really good thing, just to make some money, be able to buy some properties, have some other, be able to buy their houses. I mean, you can't even buy a car there, because there's the demand is so high that even a 1977 Lada is like $15,000, so that people can't afford those things.
Do you think it'll be incremental, Tom? If they get some more freedom, will it be inching toward more capitalism, or did you sense something ready to blow up there?
No, I sense a revolution in a sense, but not a strong revolution like that. I think the European influence has already been in there, and I think they've witnessed some of that. And I think they really want democracy. What the Cuban people don't want is they don't want to see Walmarts and McDonald's corporations taking over their Havana and places like that. I think they would like some democracy, but a controlled amount.
I get that, and yet, I can't imagine that there wouldn't be a lot of shoppers in there, though I hear Tom. Lillian, yes?
Tom, one of the things that your listeners brought up that we haven't talked about is the effect of the embargo. I mean, many people in Cuba in the early 90s were convinced, including several Cuban officials that I had to deal with for my visa, were convinced that in fact, if the United States had removed the embargo, the whole system would have collapsed. And in fact, that it would have had a complete collapse of the state and the kind of vast, rapid crisis that hopefully will not take place.
So you're saying the U.S. has been propping up the Castro regime with its embargo.
Yeah, the embargo really does a lot of favors for a government that needs to control information. And it also does a lot of favors for a government that needs to justify lack of access of goods to a lot of goods and services, in fact, that are produced in Cuba. They say that they have to ration them because there are so few. People that live on a state wage, librarians that live on a state wage at the National Library, I know a lot of them that don't have shoes, and they haven't gotten a new pair of shoes in 10 years because they can't afford it. Now, there are shoes that are being made in Cuba by Italian companies that use the cheap labor and the state facilities to produce those shoes, but they can't buy them because they're sold for $40 or $50.
Right. A lot of shoes at Walmart, but low wages too. Brian Littell, what are you looking for in the next few weeks or months here if we want to look for indicators about how this is going to evolve, unfold?
Well, obviously, what we've been saying all along, the health of the Castro brothers, the public visibility of the Castro brothers. My expectation, Tom, is that Raul is now going to be the senior partner in this government. I don't think Fidel is going to be back in the saddle again, as he has been in the past. I think that the succession, the dynastic Marxist succession, is now underway and accelerating. I do expect that Raul is going to focus in the beginning of his tenure on securing his flanks, on trying to mobilize the leadership behind him, and I think he'll be able to do that. He then will face the much more difficult challenge of trying to appeal to the Cuban population. He's going to have to give them something, some kind of material satisfaction. Mm-hmm. Raul is not going to be able to govern the way Fidel has all these years. Raul is going to have to provide bread, not circuses. Raul does not have charismatic appeal. He's not loved. He's not liked even by the Cuban people.
So more
so
brass tacks.
He's going to have to compensate for that.
Lillian, we just got a few seconds. What's your dream for this country now?
Well, my dream would be, in fact, that the U.S. would stay back and the Cubans would stay back. Let Raul take power if that's what's going to happen. And let's see what the Cuban people do, because I think that's the wild card. And really what they do and how they deal with Raul and what they force out of him or that he responds to, I think that's really what matters.
A new day dawning in Cuba, what it looks like, we're going to have to wait and see. But this is a great sort of view forward. Lillian Guerra at Yale, author of The Myth of Jose Marti, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And Brian Littell at the University of Miami, formerly CIA in Latin America, author of After Fidel. Mr. Littell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.